This is Countryfile Live 2019, the podcast that lets you relive some of the best moments from the talks and presentations that happened in the National Trust Theatre at this year's BBC Countryfile Live event at Blenheim Palace. In this series, you'll hear from the likes of Ray Mears on the best time to get involved with nature, from J.B. Gill on his transition from fame to farming, and from Timothy Bentinck, a.k.a. David Archer, who gives us a peek behind the scenes of the Archers. In this episode, we join Countryfile presenter Charlotte Smith in conversation with Ben Scott Robinson, co-founder of The Small Robot Company, Will Evans, host of the Rock and Roll Farming podcast, David Ferguson, chair of Beeswax Dyson Farming, Kit Franklin from Hands Free Hector, and Professor Alistair Driver, director of Rewilding Britain. In this extract, they discuss the dangers of bad soil health, the benefits of rewilding, and the introduction of robot farming.
Let's start on the end with you, Ben.
Well, as far as I'm concerned, because I'm looking at this from a hammer provider and it's a nail, then of course it does, you know. I think that there are so many challenges at the moment with being able to produce just the food that we need for the current population. And there was a statistic recently that said we have to produce 75% more food per hectare of available land by 2050. And I know previously there were conversations saying that there's an awful lot of food that's lost in waste and that is driving obesity epidemics, etc. But there is still a huge requirement to increase the amount of food that we produce. And if we carry on going with the way we're going with food production, then we are going to be creating a wasteland which is incapable of producing any food at all if we carry on at this rate. So the answer is yes from my side.
Will, you are a farmer. Are you envisaging radical change on your farm?
I think I'll be very surprised if any of us say no to the answer. I think very much is a yes. I think at the moment, you know, 9 million people died from insufficient nutrition last year. That number's going up. In the West, I mean, that's mostly in the developing world. In the West, we're seeing the rise of food banks, 19% increase in the use of food banks in the UK last year. And yet, we have everything in the UK. We have the climate, the infrastructure, the expertise, groundbreaking research. It's all there. So yes, I think it does have to change. We have to obviously look at climate change, rising sea levels, depleting sources of groundwater, soil health. I sneaked in some of the debates in here earlier. I was pleased to see soil health talked about. We are going to, I mean, this, people have mentioned there might only be 30 harvests left. That's pretty serious. People have been talking about soil health for a long, long time, but I think now is the time where we really have to start looking at it very, very seriously, and I'm very pleased that it is being talked about a lot more.
David.
Well, I think that it needs to continue to evolve, which it is doing anyway, always has done, and ever since Malthus, it's decided that it can meet the challenges of growing population. There are so many variables, and the trouble is, because there are so many variables, that's why it's almost impossible to get people to agree and policies to emerge, whether nationally or internationally, to try and address it. But how big is the population going to be? How much is going to be produced anyway? How much will technology do it without huge change, but with evolution? And I think, you know, we struggle, really, to actually coalesce around simple solutions. But I think the real issue is at what cost can we feed the world? And the way we're heading at the moment, some of the traditional techniques that we're using are making us look at issues that aren't just about whether there's enough food, but whether we're going to be here at all. So there is obviously a very serious imperative there.
Kit.
Yes, I feel inadequately equipped with good stats that we've already been hit with, but ultimately we have to feed a growing population with less land, less water, less hydrocarbons. So to do that, we need to get more sustainable. We need to be more precise with the way in which we apply inputs into any agricultural system. And we need to be stamping out waste wherever it occurs, be that feed waste on an animal farm or fertilizers and sprays that are being put in the incorrect place on an arable farm. So, yeah, I don't have any good stats, but I do agree we do need to change.
Alistair.
Yeah, ditto. But actually, I don't think we need to produce more food. I think we need to be much more efficient with the food we do produce. We heard a lot this morning about the 30 to 40% wastage figures. That is a global disgrace. It's not just this country. But we have the technology and we have the skills to be able to do something about that. We know it's a big issue. And if we could tackle that in a significant way, we wouldn't need to produce more food. That's the first thing to say. So it's not that farming per se needs to change. Society needs to change, and farming needs assistance to make that happen through the supply chain. The second thing to say is we know that biodiversity is going backwards. We have great data in this country. We know about the decline in wildlife overall. We know that certain types of farming can be superb for biodiversity, and we now know that rewilding can be absolutely amazing for biodiversity because there are a growing number of projects around the country which do that. So what we need to do is now embrace this system which has already been promoted by Gove's team, public money for public goods. We need to see that through because that could produce the first radical change in the way we manage our land in my 40 years in nature conservation. And we really need to work hard to make sure that is seen through so that landowners, not just farmers, are rewarded for the way they manage their land for the benefit of society as a whole.
You mentioned their rewilding. Just explain very briefly what you mean by it and where you want to do it.
Okay. The first thing to say is rewilding Britain has a slightly different approach to the really extreme approach that you will hear and see in the media. So we are working, I cover England and Wales for Rewilding Britain, and I am working continually with farmers and landowners to try and develop rewilding initiatives. It is not about wolves and bears and kicking people off the land. It is about trying to work to create natural processes so that over time, and this is a very long time, nature can start to lead. And where we've done that for 10 or 15 years in this country, we've seen amazing transformation. Now, in all those places where we've seen that biodiversity transformation, food is still being produced. It might not be quite so much food. It tends to be places where it's fairly low-grade agricultural land anyway. But food is still being produced and other products can be produced. Flood risk can be reduced, water quality improved, health and well-being opportunities, carbon sequestration. So it's really about trying to restore natural processes at scale so that biodiversity recovers while still ensuring that people are engaged in that environment.
And for you, even if there is a slight dip in the amount of food being grown, that's not an issue?
Well, you asked me, I forgot to answer that bit about how much. And Rewilding Britain has a target of 1 million hectares to be rewilded in Britain by 2100. Now, 1 million hectares sounds a lot, but it's only just over 4% of the country. And a lot of that 4% is already fairly remote, rural, relatively low-intensity agriculture. At the moment, the figure is less than 1%, what we would call natural processes prevailing. So we've got a few percent to go, but when you think that 70% of this land is agricultural land in some form, then I think if we can tweak a little bit to get to that 4%, we will do enough to restore wildlife, whilst if we reduce the food waste issue significantly, 5 or 10% reduction in that, you could still manage with 3 or 4% less agricultural land. That's all we're talking about.
Okay, let's talk briefly about some of the technology. I'm going to look at you, Ben, because you've brought some with you. Introduce us to your friend and explain what the heck it's for.
Okay, so we are building a service of robots that we call Tom, Dick and Harry, with the idea that they will look after and produce an arable crop, initially a wheat crop, all the way from planting up to, but not including harvesting. This is Tom. Tom is the small monitoring robot. Tom's job is to live on a farm and spend all day, every day, going up and down rows, collecting data on the soil, on the crops, and on the weeds. And by doing that, the farmer and our own system has a constant and ongoing view of each individual plant within a crop. So this is far more detailed than it's possible to get from satellite imagery or from drone imagery. It also allows us to collect other data directly from the soil itself so we can understand about soil health and can do fantastic things around that. And the idea for this is that we can, once we understand where every crop plant is and we understand how healthy or how well that crop plant is growing, then we can look after that crop plant individually. And by looking after that crop plant individually, then we can both reduce the amount of chemicals we're using, both to encourage it to grow with fertilizers or to look after it using pesticides or fungicides, etc. And we can also massively increase the actual yield. Because in this country, and correct me if I'm wrong, I'm looking directly at Will here, but the average yield for wheat, for example, is about 8 tons a hectare. But if you go to places... Just checking. Just checking. If you go to some of the agricultural research centres where they have people with clipboards who are looking after these little tiny test areas of wheat, they can get up to 20 tons per hectare for wheat. So if you have the care and if you have the understanding, if you can look after those wheat plants, in principle, in theory, you can more than double the amount of food you're producing per hectare while using less chemicals at the same time.
So how far away is this from reality?
So we are releasing the first part of our service, which is gathering that per plant data in October. So we have 20 customers who have prepaid for our service, and we're going to work with them. One of those customers is National Trust Wimpole Estate in Cambridgeshire. Another one is the John Lewis Partnership's Leckford Estate, where they grow food that's sold in Waitrose. And we will be providing this per plant view on a part of their fields, not the entire thing, which will allow them to be able to see where all the weeds are. Now, we can't kill those weeds right yet, but we can allow them to make choices in terms of how they kill the weeds, whether that's using what they call variable rate spraying, so they can actually just spray the plants that need to be killed rather than the whole thing, or by manually going out and pulling out individual plants if you're talking about really pernicious weeds like things like blackgrass and brome.
So how far away are we from the next bit, which is the robot that follows the information and zaps the weeds?
We are looking for the zapping bit to be working for the start of next season.
Oh, right, so really quite near.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So. Okay, so how much money are we talking? Lots?
In terms of... To develop
it or
for a farm?
I don't know quite how.
Oh, I see. So we're providing it as a service. So we charge the farmer a per hectare per year fee for the delivery of that, which works out to be marginally under what it costs at the moment for them to be able to produce it.
Okay, so I'm going to go to the two farmers, obviously. Would you like one? Some?
Yeah, well, I'm an investor in small robo companies.
Oh, right. I'm going to ignore everything you say from here on in because you're biased.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons why I invested in it, and I think why a lot of farmers are excited about this is, so for a long time I've been going to big agricultural events, the likes of cereals, and apologies if there's any of the cereals.
The cereal show happens in the east of England every year. If you want to meet an arable farmer, it's the best place to go.
Yeah, but you go there now and there's tractors as big as a small bungalow. You know, the machinery is off the charts in the terms of its size and its cost. And it costs hundreds of thousands of pounds. And I've been going there for years. And over the last few years, I've come away sort of feeling a bit cold, a bit detached from it. It doesn't feel right. And as margins have gone down, and it just all seems so wrong. And things like small robot company and what they're doing. And we haven't even gone to soil structure. This machinery is so big, and I mentioned the soil before. It's having such a detrimental effect on compaction in soils. You know, we're having these wet. I mean, I live in northeast Wales. It's rained for about 3 weeks. We're trying to do harvest. We're taking great big tractors into the fields. It's making a mess. It's going great big tracks up the fields, and we can't go on like that. And climate change is only going to make that worse. So things like small robot company that's going to be targeted, it's going to reduce our input costs. I had a spray delivery not long ago. Spray delivery man dropped it off, put all the boxes in the spray store, all these bottles of chemicals, and I looked at it and I thought, what are we doing? You know, this is costing me a fortune to protect my crops, and I have to do it at the moment. I wish I didn't have to, but I do. But I hope that things like Small Robot Company and what Kit's doing at Hansfree Hector are going to really help farmers like me be able to reduce things like pesticides, chemical fertilizers and input costs, and be much, much better for the soil.
Kit, just describe Hansfree Hector for anyone who doesn't know.
We're working on much the same principles as Ben and his team. In fact, I think Ben first got the idea off of my old boss.
They are our genesis. The stuff that Hansfree Hector is doing is absolutely phenomenal. Right. Sorry.
So basically the idea is, can we farm with smaller, lighter, but more precise machines, as we've already said? So much for what Will's just said, tractors got very big, not good for the soil, not good for compaction, not good for root growth, ultimately limiting yields. And also these big tractors and sprayers are very imprecise in the way they put their chemical on. How we're slightly different with Small Robot is, I spent a long time talking about robots that zapped weeds and would do this and do that, and farmers, no offence, sometimes struggled to get on board with that. And I'm from a farming background, and actually, heart of hearts, I struggled to get on board with it as well. You know, I liked the principles of what I was saying. I didn't necessarily like the image of the small vacuum cleaner that would go out into my field and do things. So the way we came at it is, could we farm with things that traditionally look like tractors, that look like combines, but just be smaller and therefore better for the soil and more precise? Much like we would have farmed with 50 or 60 years ago, the difference is we don't have the people of 50 or 60 years ago. So tractors and machinery have all got bigger, basically because we don't have enough people to drive them, and because we've got bigger farms and we need high work rates. So if all these tractors could drive themselves, there's nothing stopping them being smaller. So we basically farm a hectare of land in Shropshire with compact tractors, tractors like you might see in the park or on the golf course, and combines that are taken from trial plots like were described earlier. We've taken these small-scale machines, we've made them robotic, and for the last 3 years, we've basically farmed without ever going into our hectare of land. Now, just to pick up on something that Will said, in terms of, we're starting to already see the benefits of that small, lighter machine. Last winter, we had 117 days of rain of 140 days on our field site in Shropshire. I know that because I have three weather stations that all tell me. Everybody, when we needed to go out and put our first fertilizer dose on in March time onto our winter wheat, everybody in our area could not get their timing correct. And if you know anything about growing crops, it's all about timing. And nobody could go farming, no one could put the fertilizer on other than us. We were the only people, the week we had, there was one dry day, so it rained every other day, but on that one dry day, our small light tractor with its small light sprayer could go on the field, travel, not cause big ruts, not cause damage, and we got the fertilizer on. Everyone else missed their timing because they were restricted by the colossal size of their machines. So what we're trying to do is put all these theories that people have been talking about for 20 years, really, into action within a real field environment.
David, just describe how big Beeswax Dyson is as a farming entity these days.
How large? Well, we are farming 35,000 acres. But one of the things which we suffer from is from being categorised as a mega farm. And we had the launch of the Food Farming and Countryside Commission the other day, which I was on, and there was a question about mega farms. And unfortunately, Michael Gove answered it by saying that Dyson was something he thought were doing a good job. Well, we are actually about six farms, different parts of the country, all operated as separate units with their own farm manager and so on. So we own that land, but we farm it in smaller blocks. So yes, we are large, and what we try to do, therefore, is to use the benefits of one company structure to try and control the costs and actually enable us to farm in those different areas with different risk, different weather patterns, and all the rest of it to try and produce a profitable business.
And does it work? Is this a profitable farming business?
It works, and I think the reason it works at the moment is because we are not just straight agriculture. We have some anaerobic digestion plants. We have some residential property. and so on. And so we are trying to marry those up as far as we can so that we can provide heat and power to residential developments or barns that we've converted, or we use digestate from the AD plants to improve the organic matter of the soils. But we are obviously very interested in technology and on and improving what we do there. But we because we are already a technology company, we don't want to get into manufacturing more, because this is a diversification out of that. So we are looking, and what the panel have already said is absolutely where we are too. We have a motto which is to produce more with less, and that means less sprays, less chemicals, less weight on the soil, healthier soils and all the rest of it.
So even for you in a big farm, if you see what I mean, where big machinery makes sense because you've got lots of big fields and it's quick, you would still be attracted to a smaller unit or to smaller units, I suppose.
Well, we think soil is the most important thing on the farms, and so the danger of compaction is really high. We have done that by trying to improve the soils so that they are more resilient and they are there's a greater biodiversity within the soil, and it tends to support things rather better. So we do try, but I think if we were able to use a smaller units, they'd probably. I was thinking about it last night and thinking, actually, probably running themselves over a 24-hour period, and then I thought of the villages next door and whether they would really like that. But apart from that, you know, the economies would be there. And it must make sense. A lot of it is about how you move the stuff, the grain, where you get it to, where you dry it, where you invest in the stores, how you get it to where you're selling it to. So the logistics are a key part of it. What we've heard about so far is really interesting work on the robotics of actually growing stuff. What we've then got to look at is how we actually then move things around in an efficient and sensible way. So what we want to do is do it in a way which enables us to keep a much better environmental profile alongside the farming that we're doing.
Do you see this as the key to growing more with less? Is your sort of plan, yes, to tread lightly, but also produce more food?
Yeah, it must be part of that, absolutely.
Alistair, you're looking a bit pained. Are you all right?
Yeah.
You don't buy this.
I bring us back to the food waste thing. I mean, I accept that is the way we will go. Technology will mean that we can do more with less, but I really think we should be focusing much more as a society on the wastage and not putting so much pressure on farmers to do that. And we should also be tackling the price of food, which is in some cases ridiculously cheap now and should be valued better. Can I just say a little bit about scale? Because it really matters when it comes to rewilding. So it's very interesting for me. I've been working for Rewilding Britain for just over 2.5 years now. And when I started, it was very much about me trying to knock on people's doors, as it were, to get a way in to talk about rewilding with landowners, farmers around the country. Now I can't cope with the demand, so I'm having to be a bit choosy. And actually, the greater benefit for rewilding is to focus on the big areas of land. And so I'm generally dealing now with large estates who can probably afford to think about a bit of flexibility on the way they manage 1,000 hectares here or 1,000 hectares there, because they have so much land. Now, I know that's not an ideal situation, but it is a great place to start to demonstrate the benefits. So scale matters when it comes to opportunities for genuine rewilding, where natural processes are starting to predominate.
Or you need a group of people to get together so that you...
Yeah. There's a cluster in Norfolk, which I helped to set up, which has been publicised recently quite a bit, who are now getting together. They all own estates around a river valley, and they're all contributing their riverside land, because it's less productive, to a bigger rewilding scheme, which might be a couple of 1,000 hectares, which is significant in lowland Britain.
So in an ideal world, would you like to see that sort of alongside one of Ben's robot systems, I'm going to call it?
Yes, I think that's how it's going to go, actually. What I would love to see is this technology helping to make the delivery of the environmental land management scheme easier and more flexible for farmers. If you had technology that can monitor this stuff quickly and effectively, then we could have a system which is involves more trust, more flexibility. Because as we know from the past system, it just isn't working. Everything takes too long. There's too much finicky nitpicking about, you know, what you do and where you do it. We need more flexibility. And if we had remote monitoring like this, that could be achievable.
I'm just going to briefly ask Kit, who you've gone from hands-free hectare and you've got all ambitious now and you're doing a hands-free farm. What's the limit of this autonomous, eventually, weed-zapping technology?
I mean, we've done lots at Harper with weed-zapping. We've been messing around with killing weeds with lasers for 5 or 6 years. It's what I did as a researcher when I first started work after graduating. And there's lots of potential, but it's also not quite there yet, from my view. There might be other technologies. Yeah. So, but ultimately, it comes down to energy density, okay? So at the moment, we get chemicals in cans, they can be transported, we put them in some water, we can cover vast areas really quickly. And all the other options at the moment don't cover the land as quickly and are less convenient, frankly. So we all on this table, on panel, would love to do it differently, but ultimately it's about making a system that works as well, but is equally convenient and cost-effective. And that's where the challenges are.
Hands up if you would like to see genetically modified crops grown here in the UK. Okay, and hands up if you would like to see GE, genetically edited crops. Okay, a few more. Let's ask the panel. GMGE? David?
Well, I think what's interesting about GM is that at the moment where we are producing within Europe, we're not using GM technology, and we're operating essentially within a European market where nobody else is either. So that suits quite well because, you know, we don't have to go there. And we don't particularly want to go there. But if you move to a world system where we take away our tariff barriers, we change our rules, we decide that we're going to get into bed with America on the basis of some other reciprocal trade arrangement, we could find ourselves, if we are farming as we are at the moment, being undercut by stuff produced on a world market where genetic modification is used and enables them to come in. I doubt whether there would be particular controls, and there you would be able to buy your cheap food in the supermarket, which would undercut food produced in this country. That's a worrying place to be. We would like not to do it, but you know, we will need to survive. So I think we just have to see what would happen. If the time came when it was the only way to compete, then I think what we would really want to see is a very rigorous scientific system, which alongside what Europe have been using hitherto, to make sure that what we were using was not storing up problems in the future. You know, the whole glyphosate issue has taken something that was used in moderation to something that has been used to such a scale that it has raised all sorts of questions and caused all sorts of publicity and difficulties for a whole load of people, and then there's more stored up in the future. So we're playing in a really dangerous area here, and I think we need, and this is one of the sort of things where the farming industry needs absolute certainty to enable us to move forward, rather than leaving it us to take risks and try and plot our own route.
My standpoint is you have to weigh up morals and ethics versus science, yeah? Agriculture is the coming together of technology and science that enables the few to feed the many. That's what agriculture is, yeah? It's an industry. We're always hit. Listen to the Today programme. We'll be hit with industrial agriculture. Yeah, you know what? We are an industry. 2% feed 98%. We should embrace that. And we can only do that by using cutting-edge technology and science. And as time moves forward, if what we need to move to is the cutting edge of science and technology, including gene editing, then as far as I'm concerned, that's what we'll need to do. think you have to be very careful not to mix your science and your ethics.
So there was an interesting conversation, I think, happened on the radio yesterday where George Monbiot was asked about this, who is quite a rigorous environmentalist. And he was asked specifically, you know, what do you think is the problem? And he said, the problem isn't this. It's not whether you're using GM or GE food. The problem is whether you are bringing in systems which are purely for the good of the manufacturer over the good of the consumer. And that really, I think, is the issue here. You know, if there is a GE crop that does no damage to the environment, that provides food of a suitable level of nutritional value for lower cost that can be produced in a drought-resistant environment, which means you use less other chemicals, that's a good thing. I can't see a problem with that. If the purpose is just to drive a profit for the company that is making the seed that is going in the ground and has no benefit in any other context, that's a bad thing. It's never that black and white. But ultimately, that is really what this argument is about. It's not specifically about GE or GM.
So 2 points, really. Number one, I think it's very telling that very few hands went up in the room. And as farmers and food producers, we should be listening to our customers. So you guys are the people who are buying our food. If you don't want GM, then we should take that very seriously. Gene editing, personally, I think is quite different to GM. As Charlotte said, it's basically taking a trait out. So the plant might be vulnerable to a certain disease. If you can take that out so that that plant isn't vulnerable to that disease, and therefore you don't have to spray as much fungicide, I think that's probably a good thing. And my second point really is that we have the luxury in here. We're just outside. There's all these wonderful food providers. We are a wealthy country. Food is, I think, the third cheapest food supply in the world. We really don't have to worry too much about food in this country. I suspect if you asked an audience of people in the developing world, the response might be quite different, where there's obviously a lot more hunger and you know, people are thinking about where food's going to come from their children. So I think it's a very, very interesting debate. I think farmers debate this all the time. It isn't just, you know, farmers are all for it and they're not. You see this on social media a lot. Farmers have some really good discussions about this and where it's going to go. And I think, as Ben said, it is a worry that these things are in the hands of big companies. And I think that can be a worry for farmers as well.
Yeah, so you just mentioned something there which for me is very important. One other issue which I'm seriously hoping that technology will make a big difference to in the long term is our better understanding of the long-term cocktail impact of pesticides, chemicals in the countryside. We still don't know enough about that long-term impact. Having been a biologist all my life and being a moth trapper for decades and seeing the decline in numbers of invertebrates out there, we all know this, it is a really, really serious issue that is going to impact on farming in the future. So not just for the sake of the environment, but for the sake of farming, we need to get to the bottom of this. And if GM can be done in a way which doesn't have an impact on ecosystems and can help us tackle that particular pesticide issue as you touched on, then I think that's got to be really seriously considered.
Let's have some questions from the audience.
A lot of what you guys produce, how much of it actually goes to feed human beings? And I think a lot of what we've actually been talking about here is actually the question, can technology improve efficiency and productivity in farming? Which is a very different question than can technology feed the world?
So David, does actually the entire system need to change, not what you're doing on your farm?
Well, I think if you're going to start looking at world agriculture, and you look at the disruption to food systems caused by warfare and conflict in large parts of the world, you've got a whole lot of reasons why the food doesn't get to the right places at the right time. You know, kidnapping of aid workers doesn't entice people to go and work in some of the more dangerous parts of the world. So we've got some real problems in the world about the food being in the right place and available to the right people at the right time. Yes, of course, there is. We could do better with improving how we get the food to people. I think the difficulty for individual farmers is that farmers have to work on market signals. And otherwise, you'll get yourself in a terrible muddle if you're trying to work out how you can solve a whole lot of issues. We're not all of us, any of us, big enough, even the size of business we are a pinprick in the overall food distribution system. So we do, and we have in British agriculture in general, produced food for the marketplace as we see it. And I think what is necessary is for us to work harder at being more relevant in the food chain so that we do get closer to the people that receive the food. There are some really interesting local community feeding systems that have been set up. We have Riverford down in our part of the world, in Devon, where I live. And there are a number of things that we highlighted in the Food Farming and Countryside Commission report about community agriculture. So I think there is room for a whole variety of different farming systems. But I suspect it would be very difficult, the bigger you get, to be able to know exactly where everything that you have grown has ended up. But maybe that will happen, and maybe blockchain technology will enable a much better way of actually consumers connecting up with the origin of the food that they're buying, and I think digital technology will help in that.
I think it's a really interesting question, actually. I think we're going to see giant steps forward in this over the coming years. I've been sort of really excited lately. I've been looking, reading quite a lot about vertical farming systems, things like that, that are actually in cities. There's the place in, I think in the Netherlands, there's a floating dairy farm in the harbour in Antwerp, is it? Yeah. I thought that was absolutely fantastic. There's a lot of these kind of things that are going to be producing food right on the doorstep. I know that's sort of in the West, and we may be talking about the developing world, but I think technology can help massively. And, you know, things like just smartphones, there's been some brilliant apps developed in the developing worlds, in African countries, where people are, they've been developed to use farm-to-farmer knowledge sharing and things like that over there, which is just fantastic. It's really inspiring to see, and it's really helping small-scale farmers. It's not about giant farming systems. This is about helping small-scale farmers become efficient. So I think we're living in a really exciting time for farming, and I think over the next sort of 10, 20 years, we will see giant steps forward in that regard.
So I think there are two elements to that. One is around the efficiency of food production from the raw material, and I think that's something that we're chronically bad at in the developed world. The production of ready meals, the production of processed foods, etc., is massively wasteful. And I think a lot of that ties into what you were saying about the amount of energy used in the production of the foods. So looking at that system, and coming back to a point that Mehmet Batters made earlier on about, you know, eating processed foods rather than eating red meat, I think that there's a real problem there. On the other side, I think that so much food is produced in the developing world at a subsistence level, mainly, and they can't get out of the loop of what they're doing because they have a hectare, half a hectare to be able to work with, and there is literally no form of mechanization or improved system that they can adopt at that scale. And I think that is a huge area to be looked at and changed, because if you can bring in the levels of efficiency and improvements of food production for those people, then you will radically change the way that food is produced in countries where there is the biggest debt.
Yeah, so I obviously entirely support the efficiency point, which is a point I made right up front. One other thing that we need to bear in mind, and I don't think it's been mentioned yet today, but it's becoming increasingly obvious that there is a huge belt of the world through Canada, Northern Europe, and Russia that, unfortunately, this is a double-edged sword, is going to become more croppable and grazable because of climate warming. And if you look at, you know, these maps of the world, you'll see what a huge tract of land that is. Now, that means there is going to be more food in the world, not anything to do with Britain, and this comes back to the point that I wanted to make. I think we should focus on getting our own house in order here, because there is every opportunity for the world to producing a lot more food. If we can get our own house in order in terms of efficiency and reducing wastage and improving the technology, then we can help lead the world in those respects. I think it's a very important point to remember now that, as I said, a sort of consequence of climate warming is that huge areas of land in the world will become more farmable going forward. Now, that, of course, could have perverse consequences for accelerating climate warming but by removing forest, but that's another day.
I'm going to say something that's probably anti what you want to hear, but the 30-70 stat you said about subsistence and small-scale farming, I think you're going to see that slide the way against where you want it to be, potentially, I think, from the way you put your question. We do a lot of work in India. I have colleagues who do lots of work in parts of Africa, China. And urbanisation is a problem we're seeing everywhere. So there's a real appetite in all those places for more mechanisation and more technology. So, well, you know, we're working on projects in India that are all about putting technology apps that can identify weeds, remote irrigation systems onto farms, because actually they've got growing agricultural population, ageing agricultural populations, and decreasing populations as a whole as everyone chases to the cities. So, sadly, from your point of view, I think maybe, we're going to see more in industrial farming around the world in the next decades, not less.
And there, ladies and gentlemen, we will have to leave it. Could we thank our panel? Thank you very much, guys.
Thanks for listening to this extract from the many talks and debates that happened in the National Trust Theatre at BBC Countryfile Live 2019. To learn more about this and other audio programmes from the National Trust, go to nationaltrust.org.uk/podcasts. And to purchase your ticket for BBC Countryfile Live 2020, go to countryfilelive.com. This is a National Trust podcast recorded at BBC Countryfile Live 2019.